From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, from slave to preacher to abolitionist and suffragist, Sojourner Truth has become a symbol of courage and power in African American and women's history. She's best known for her "Aren't I a Woman" speech, a speech she may never have given, according to a new biography. We'll talk with biographer Nell Irvin Painter. Also, coordinating election coverage for a TV network, we talk with Hal Bruno, director of political coverage for ABC News. 4 years ago, he moderated the vice presidential debate between Gore, Quayle, and Admiral Stockdale. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews New Adventures in Hi-Fi, REM's latest release. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. Palestinian police and Israeli soldiers exchanged gunfire today near the West Bank town of Ramallah. A Palestinian doctor says three Palestinians have been killed in the clashes, and there were violent demonstrations in Jerusalem as well. The Palestinians are protesting Israel's completion of a tunnel at an Islamic holy site in Jerusalem. NPR's Eric Weiner reports.
Several hundred Palestinian protesters marched to the walls of Jerusalem's Old City, where some threw bottles and clashed with police. Several of the protesters were injured. In the West Bank town of Ramallah, nearly 100 Palestinians were injured when Israeli police fired rubber bullets. The Palestinians were protesting completion of a tunnel underneath Jerusalem's Old City. They charged the project threatens the stability of the Al-Aqsa Mosque, the third holiest site in Islam. But Dan Bahat, the Israeli archaeologist who supervised the excavation, says the Palestinian concerns are unfounded.
It has got nothing to do. It has got nothing to do. As if you'll say that this tunnel may damage the Empire State Building in New York. It's about the same thing.
But Palestinians are not convinced, and they vow to continue the protest. This is Eric Weiner in Jerusalem.
Federal prosecutors say Joseph Waldholz, the ex-husband of Utah Congresswoman Enid Green, kept writing worthless checks and used heroin after pleading guilty to bank fraud in June. Waldholz was ordered to appear before a judge tomorrow to show cause why his bail should not be revoked. He's free awaiting sentencing on the bank fraud charges. An FBI investigation alleges that Waldholz wrote tens of thousands of dollars in bad checks over the summer. Russian President Boris Yeltsin will undergo heart bypass surgery, but later this fall. That decision came today from a meeting in Moscow of some of the world's leading cardiologists. NPR's Andy Bowers reports.
The gathering included American surgeon Michael DeBakey, the man who performed the world's first successful heart bypass. DeBakey and other leading specialists met today at Moscow's Central Clinical Hospital, where President Yeltsin has been undergoing tests for nearly 2 weeks. The surgeons came to review Yeltsin's medical history and assess his fitness for surgery. Although not all details of the president's health are known, doctors say his heart suffered damage this summer from what could have been a heart attack. Former aides also claim Yeltsin has long been a heavy drinker and that he has liver damage that could complicate surgery. Nonetheless, the Interfax news agency says the doctors have decided to go ahead with surgery, although no date has yet been announced. Yeltsin's chief surgeon said recently he believes the operation should be postponed for up to 2 months to give Yeltsin time to rest. I'm Andy Bowers in Moscow.
On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down nearly 5 points at 5,869 in moderate trading of 208 million shares. On the over-the-counter market, however, the Nasdaq Composite Index is up just over 3 points. This is NPR News. A Navy intelligence analyst in Virginia has been charged with passing defense secrets to South Korea. Robert Kim is a native of Korea who became a naturalized American citizen. He's employed by the Office of Naval Intelligence in Maryland. He was arrested last night. Although South Korea is a U.S. ally, it is interested in American intelligence on North Korea and in the latest American military technology. Three international judges will decide today whether the trial of a man accused of genocide in Rwanda should be postponed because he's ill. The suspect is accused of taking part in the brutal murder of Tutsis in Rwanda in 1994. The BBC's Martin Dawes reports from Tanzania.
According to the Belgian lawyer defending Georges Rutaganda, the International Tribunal has already offered to drop the 8 counts of genocide and crimes against humanity because of his client's ill health. Luc de Temerman won't say what's wrong with the former businessman, who's said to have been a vice president of the notorious Inter-Mahamwe militia. But he is expected to present medical evidence saying that the genocide suspect will not survive if he's kept in custody. Mr. de Temerman says that he wants a postponement and the chance eventually to prove his client's innocence in court. In the international indictments, 38-year-old Georges Rutaganda is accused of participating in a massacre of Tutsis at a technical school, of organizing searches for Tutsis who were later killed, and of murdering a man with a machete.
The BBC's Martin Dawes reporting. Another tropical storm has formed in the eastern Atlantic. It's named Isidore. The storm has wind speeds of 65 miles an hour. A student pulled a gun and shot one of his teachers to death at an alternative school in Decatur, Georgia this morning. The 43-year-old teacher was dead on arrival at a nearby medical center. The student was arrested. The teenager had just transferred to the school a week ago. I'm Craig Windham, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Sojourner Truth is an inspirational figure in African-American history and women's history. After 30 years in slavery and 15 years of preaching the Holy Spirit, she became an abolitionist and suffragist. Perhaps she's best known for her Irondale Woman speech. But a new biography suggests she may never have made that speech and that we may have mythologized her life to suit our need for a strong symbol. Which isn't to say Sojourner Truth wasn't a courageous or inspirational woman. My guest historian, Nell Irvin Painter, is the author of Sojourner Truth, A Life, A Symbol, which examines Sojourner Truth's life and its place in African American and women's history. Sojourner Truth was born a slave in New York, and slavery in the North is not a well-known chapter of American history.
I think that Southern society's gotten a bum rap in that way because slavery was a national institution when this country became this country. In the northern states, slavery was abolished first in New England. And so in my state of New Jersey, for instance, there were still a few old slaves in 1860. When Sojourner Truth was born in about 1797, there was slavery in New Jersey, there was slavery in Pennsylvania, there was slavery in New York, there was slavery in Connecticut. So there were slaves all over the place.
The slaves in New York, where Sojourner Truth lived, were to be freed in 1827, but she managed to get her freedom about a year and a half before that, and she actually had a plan to do it. How did she manage that?
She managed her plan to get free by figuring out what was fair to her master and what was fair to herself. So she was to have been freed by law on the 4th of July, 1827. But her master, a man named John Dumont, prized her as a worker and said, "Oh, you're such a good worker that I'm going to free you a year early in 1826. Before that time, she hurt her hand, and actually in her pictures you can see that her right hand is sort of misshapen from this injury. And she couldn't do as much work as she normally could do. And so he said, "Well, since you can't do as much work as you normally can, I'm not going to free you early." She decided that even though her hand was hurt, she could do as much work as most people. So she thought, "Well, I'll do about as much work as most people," which means doing the work of the late summer and the fall, that is, getting the crops in, and spinning about 100 pounds of wool into yarn. So I figured it would probably be around October, November of 1826 that she would have been free, having done the work that she thought was fair. And then she walked off.
She just left.
Yeah. She took her youngest baby and a handkerchief full of her belongings, and she walked off.
Did her owner try to reclaim her and track her down?
Yes, yes. And she knew he would, so she didn't go very far. She said, "I know he's going to come after me, so I'm not going to go that far, just far enough to let him know that I'm leaving." So he did try to track her down, and the people she went to, the Von Wagenens, were a kind of Christian of the early 19th century. We would call it holiness or Pentecostal or sanctified in 20th century talk. Then it was called perfectionist, and they wanted to live a pure, sort of primitive Christianity, and they didn't believe in slavery. So they paid her master for her year's work and also for her baby. So they, in essence, bought her.
And what impact did that have on Sojourner Truth's spiritual life and spiritual direction?
I'm not sure exactly how everything goes together in a one-by-one causal relationship. I prefer to think of freedom and her discovery of Methodism and then the trauma with her sons being sold in perpetual slavery. All these things together led to a tremendous spiritual crisis.
When did Isabella transform herself into Sojourner Truth, and how did she take that name for herself?
The name came from God. This is what Sojourner Truth says. And the name came from God on the 1st of June of 1843. She was working in New York, which then, of course, was just lower Manhattan. And God told her that her name was Sojourner, and she should leave, and she should go to the East and preach her truth. So she became Sojourner Truth. She went to the East, which, of course, was Brooklyn. And she went along Long Island, and then across the Long Island Sound and up the Connecticut River Valley, ending up in Northampton for the winter. She only meant to stay for the winter, and she ended up staying several years.
Now, how did she go from being a preacher to being an abolitionist and feminist?
That's a small step. That's a very small step. We think of abolitionists as non-religious people. They were very religious people. They just didn't believe in conventional religion. They were very disdainful of regular clergy, and they felt that regular clergy and conventional religion was misleading the people. So as a very effective public speaker, they were attracted to Sojourner Truth. So when she first started speaking at anti-slavery meetings, which was just a couple of years after she got to the Northampton Association, she first began to speak about the songs she was selling and how she found Jesus, which is what her regular preaching was about. And then she would say sort of vague things about, I've been a slave and it's not a good thing and it should end. But it took her several years to make the transition from being mainly a preacher to being mainly a feminist and mainly an anti-slavery speaker. So I would say that it took from, about 1843 into about 1850.
Your book about Sojourner Truth is both, a history, it's a biography, but it also examines a lot of the stories behind the myth of Sojourner Truth and questions, actually, the validity, the historical validity of a lot of those stories. A lot of what we know, a lot of what we knew before your book about Sojourner Truth was based on something called The Narrative of Sojourner Truth.
Yes.
Tell us about that, which was published in 1850.
In 1850, she sat down with a woman who was also at the Northampton Association, a woman named Olive Gilbert, a reasonably well-educated woman, probably a teacher, from Connecticut. And she dictated to Olive Gilbert her life story up to that point. This was a very common thing to do at the time because slave narratives had become popular beginning, they had been popular for a while, but they became big in 1845 with Frederick Douglass's autobiography. So after Frederick Douglass, it became something that people sought out, and there was a market for it, actually. So
and she was illiterate, so she needed somebody
She needed an amanuensis. But very often, these books serve the function of supporting the person. So it was kind of a token. You would give a certain amount of money. The book only cost about 25 cents. It was a little tiny paperback, more like a pamphlet the first time. And or you might give more, and then you would get the book in return. So it was created to make money for poor old Sojourner Truth's old age. And it ends with Sojourner Truth in 1849, this poor broken-down old woman, so she would have been about 52, and she needs some kind of assurance for her old age and retirement. Now, if you think about the Sojourner Truth whom we know, the most famous moment in her life occurs in 1851, after this time. So she got a second breath or a third breath or a fourth breath. She kept going. So in that book, we don't find the monumental Sojourner Truth, that first 1850s book. We find Sojourner Truth's childhood.
My guest is historian Nell Irvin Painter, the author of a new biography called Sojourner Truth, A Life, A Symbol. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Nell Irvin Painter, author of a new biography of Sojourner Truth. Now, you mentioned the 1850s as being this real kind of turning point in her life, the period we most remember her for. She spoke at a women's rights convention in Akron,
That's
Ohio,
right.
in 1851. And the Ain't I a Woman speech is supposed to have come from that convention.
Yes.
You challenge whether she even made that speech. Tell us, first of all, about the speech for people who aren't familiar with it, and then we'll look behind it.
All right. Most people know Sojourner Truth for the phrase, Ain't I a Woman or Aren't I a Woman, written as Aren't I a Woman, often said to make it more authentic, Ain't I a Woman, I guess more Southern, I don't know. So we think of Sojourner Truth as rolling up her sleeve and showing her strong right arm and saying, I've borne these children, they've been sold away from me, and ain't I a woman? And I've plowed and I've hoed and I've worked as hard as a man and I've eaten as much as a man when I could get it. And aren't I a woman? And she goes on like this with this refrain of aren't I a woman? And it sort of builds up to a crescendo. And the point of this story is that here is this ex-slave who comes into a meeting of white women who call themselves women's rights women. Yet they're anti-black and they don't have any backbone. They're afraid to speak up. So men take over this meeting. This is according to the story still. Men take over the meeting and they say women can't have their rights. Women are too weak. They don't know enough. God meant man to run things because God was a man and Jesus was a man and so forth. Still according to the story, Sojourner Truth then says, may I say something? And then the narrator says, yes. And all the other women say, oh, don't let her talk. Don't let her talk, because then it'll get abolitionism all mixed up. Don't let her talk. And then Sojourner Truth sort of rises up, and she makes this valiant speech. And then the whole meeting turns, and there's the tremendous applause and crying, and everybody loves it. And Sojourner Truth carries the women over into safety. That's the story.
And it's now, a great story, and it's got such
it's a
power
great story.
For women
it's
to hear the story.
Great story. And when I started talking about how there were some problems with this, several of my academic women colleagues came up and they said, oh, you just ruined my best lecture.
Well, tell us why you challenge, why you question whether Sojourner Truth ever said those words.
First, let me say that I am not the only biographer who questions this. As soon as you look into it carefully, you discover, there's some problems here. So what happened was this. This meeting occurred in May of 1851 in Akron, Ohio. Sojourner Truth was there, and she was there to sell her book. Now, there were many other women there who were used to talking aloud, and the coverage afterwards, people said, well, this meeting certainly proves that women are the equals of men because they ran this meeting beautifully. The woman who was in the chair, a woman named Frances Dana Gage, was a well-known writer and also a feminist and an anti-slavery person. And after the meeting, you know, which was very well received in the feminist and anti-slavery community, which at that time was virtually one, this is 1851, 1852 goes by, and so forth. In 1853, Sojourner Truth, looking for a blurb for a new edition of her narrative, went to see the nation's best-selling author at that time, which was Harriet Beecher Stowe. She went to Harriet Beecher Stowe to get a blurb. She got a blurb. Okay, that's 1853, 1854, 1855, 1856, 18—so on and so forth. By the Civil War, and then the Civil War is bogging down and becoming a big deal, and then 1863 and the Emancipation Proclamation and so forth, things have changed since the 50s. In 1863, 10 years after Sojourner Truth had approached Harriet Beecher Stowe for a blurb, Harriet Beecher Stowe published an article called Sojourner Truth, the Libyan Sibyl. Stowe thought that Sojourner Truth was dead. She made some other mistakes, too. But the point is that Stowe wrote this very high-profile article. It was in the Atlantic Monthly. And then, within 2 weeks of the appearance of Harriet Beecher Stowe's article, Frances Dana Gage wrote her version of Sojourner Truth. And it's in Gage's version from 1863 that we have this vision of the anti-black meeting of cowering white women, the Sojourner Truth rising up and turning the tide of the meeting and saving the day.
Well, what makes you think that this isn't just a factual representation of what happened at that meeting?
Well, the first thing that is shocking is that it comes from 12 years after the fact. And any historian is going to wonder about the validity or faithfulness of a report that's that old. The second thing is that there does exist, the closest as we can get, to a transcription of what Sojourner Truth taken down at the time she was speaking. Not only taken down at the time she was speaking, but taken down by the man who had been designated as the secretary of the meeting, someone who knew her. She stayed with the Robinsons. This man's name was Marius Robinson. She stayed with them. That was her base as she was going around speaking in northern Ohio. So this was someone who knew her, who was taking down other notes, and who was there. And in that version, which is only a quarter of the length of the Aren't I a Woman version, in that version we have no refrain. And I figure that if Sojourner Truth had said, "Aren't I a woman?" one time, Robinson might have missed it. And maybe if he were distracted, he might have missed it twice. And maybe if he had a tin ear, he might have missed it three times. But four times? No. So I think that "Aren't I a woman?" comes from Frances Dana Gage, not Sojourner Truth.
You're kind of like the bearer of bad news here.
Yes, yes.
The "Ain't I a Woman" speech is such, I can't tell you how many radio shows and magazine articles and inspirational talks I've come across over the years that were titled "Ain't I a Woman."
Yes,
and you're saying,
Black women's organization.
Exactly, right. And you're saying this probably wasn't even said by Sojourner Truth.
That's right.
Well, how do you feel as the bearer of bad tidings here?
Well, I've got several sort of competing responses to that. One is that I don't always appear as the bearer of bad tidings. I have had some young women, particularly young black women, get very upset. But older black women, that is older than undergraduate age, often are kind of relieved to learn that there wasn't this sort of outsized person who could triumph over every adversity. You know, they've been going through their lives trying to live up to Sojourner Truth and feeling like they were so weak. And then it turns out that Sojourner Truth it was not that big either. So many black women are quite relieved. So I'm only the bearer of bad tidings to many white women whose only only black woman figure is Sojourner Truth. And if you take away that Sojourner Truth, you take away their black women. And for people who can no longer use that lecture or that speech.
Well, you've hit upon something very interesting here, which is that Sojourner Truth has been a really potent symbol for white women and African-American women. And I wonder if you think that she represented something different or represents something different for white feminists who've empathized with her and really found her to be such an important, powerful woman and symbol. And for African-American women who also empathized with her and found her to be a potent, powerful symbol, are they seeing different things?
Yes and no. But I should add, talking about the bearer of bad news, that many people simply don't believe me. And the last part of my book is about, it's called The Triumph of a Symbol, and it's how this symbolic Sojourner Truth still exists. A mere historian is no match. But at any rate, black and white women, there's a big overlap of what they see in Sojourner Truth. But I think for many white women who do not know any black women, that Sojourner Truth brings blackness into their sense of what it means to be a woman, whereas other black women know other black women. So in some ways, Sojourner Truth functions in our times very much as she functioned in her own times to give blackness to the women's movement and also to give womanliness to the black movement.
If you take away some of the myth about Sojourner Truth, does she remain a very important historical figure?
I think she does. And I think she can remain a representative black woman because Sojourner Truth found a source of strength as a poor woman, an uneducated woman, a woman who had been a slave, a woman who had been abused. She found a way to make herself into a memorable personage. She found a way to express her intelligence before large crowds at a time when women's public speaking was quite unusual. And she found a way to let people know what she thought. So what she did was extraordinary in her time. But the means that she used, which was the power of the Holy Spirit, the power of the Holy Spirit is a means that black women have used, that poor people have used since time immemorial, a way of becoming more than one can by oneself. And so by reaching out for this power and empowering herself through the power of the Holy Spirit, Sojourner Truth becomes an emblematic black woman again.
Nell Irvin Painter is the author of the new book, Sojourner Truth, A Life, A Symbol. Painter is a professor of history at Princeton. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, coordinating election coverage for a TV network. We meet Hal Bruno, director of political coverage for ABC News. 4 years ago, he moderated the vice presidential debate. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews REM's new CD. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. As we near the climax of the 96 presidential campaign, we're going to check in with Hal Bruno. He's covered every presidential election since 1960. As the director of political coverage for ABC News, he works closely with the producers and correspondents for all ABC News programs on planning and editorial content. The networks are getting ready for the presidential debates. The first debate is scheduled for October 6th in Hartford. Ross Perot is suing the debate commission over its decision to exclude him. The commission's decision was based in part on the opinions of political experts and on empirical data, which indicated Perot had no chance of winning the election. I asked Bruno his reaction to Perot's lawsuit.
Well, I think he's got every right to file the lawsuit, and it's exactly what we expected he would do, but I don't think he's got a legal leg to stand on. The courts in the past have always supported the sponsors of debates in determining who they were going to have on and who they were not going to have on. So I don't think he's going to get very far with that lawsuit.
The Commission on Presidential Debates used among its criteria the opinions of Washington bureau chiefs of major news organizations to see if those people thought that Ross Perot had a chance of winning and if therefore he had a place on the debates. Was anyone at ABC consulted, to your knowledge?
To my knowledge, no. I know I wasn't called, and I don't know of anybody else at ABC that was called. Doing it that way is simply bringing in some subjective judgment to go along with the polling that they were looking at and trying to get a mix of views as to whether or not Perot might have a chance to win. And overwhelmingly, it showed that he did not have a chance to win. And as long as they established that as their criteria, they were perfectly correct in saying that they didn't want him on the debates.
Would you have responded if the commission did ask you, or do you think that would be becoming part of the story?
I'd probably respond to the question, did I think Ross Perot had a chance to win? I'd respond to that. I would not respond to a question as to whether or not he should be on the debates, because that isn't for me to be determining.
Meanwhile, Ross Perot is asking for equal time for his infomercials. Do you think he should get that?
Oh, I don't know about that, Terry. You know, what's happening here is you're seeing Ross Perot waking up to political reality. He knows that if he is not included in the debates, he's on his way to becoming a footnote in political history. I mean, 4 years ago, he was new. It was novel. He had some different ideas. People didn't know much about him, and he was able to use his money to suddenly create a political party where none had ever existed before, or to create a political candidate where none had ever existed before. And it worked. He got 19% of the vote. You got to go back to 1912 to find a third-party candidate who did as well. So it was really quite phenomenal. Now, that's in popular vote. He didn't get any electoral votes at all. This time, it's 4 years later. People have gotten to know Ross Perot in this time. His own followers have become disenchanted. He has not worn well. And now he's just another candidate.
4 years ago, you moderated the now infamous vice presidential debate between Gore Quayle and
Admiral Stockdale.
Admiral Stockdale, yeah.
James Stockdale.
What surprised you most about this debate?
I went into the debate. First of all, I've had a lot of experience in debates. I covered the first Kennedy-Nixon debate back in 1960, and I covered every debate since then. I was a panelist on the 1976 Dole-Mondale debate when they were both running for vice president. And over the years, I moderated debates at varying times during, the primaries and so on. And this was the first time in the general election campaign they were going to use the single moderator format, which I think is a pretty good format to use, because the idea behind it is that you will get the candidates talking to each other as opposed to the press panel type of thing, which is more like a press conference. The idea of the single moderator debate, I thought, was I present the topic and I sit back and let these gentlemen go at it with each other, because nobody's tuning in to hear the moderator. So I describe my role as being sort of a potted palm. And the only thing I really wanted to be concerned about was to make sure that they got equal time and that they gave each other a chance to talk.
But?
Well, I'll tell you. The first question I asked, or the first topic I presented, was, you know, the nature of the vice presidency. What are you going to be doing if you are vice president? And when it came to Admiral Stockdale, he came up with the famous, "Who am I? Why am I here?" Well, I knew what he meant. I have to say this. James Stockdale is one of the most admirable people I have ever encountered. I mean, here's a man who is a genuine war hero, a Congressional Medal of Honor winner, a brilliant philosopher. And I don't go along with the jokes that there's something wrong with Admiral Stockdale. Not at all. He was he's a fine man. He was in the wrong element. This was not his natural place to be. And I think that's part of the almost the cruelty of Ross Perot, that he would subject a man like James Stockdale to something like this.
How did you deal with Stockdale not really being in his element and being so ill at ease and unprepared?
Yeah, and I have to confess, 4 years later, I became somewhat protective of him because I did have so much respect for him. I didn't worry about Dan Quayle and Al Gore. They can take care of themselves fine. They had brass knuckles on. But I didn't want to see this fine man humiliated. And he and I had sort of a mystical eye contact, I felt. And I could tell when he wanted in and when he wanted out. Don't ask me how. I just knew by looking at him. And I could see, you don't want to come in now, Admiral. Okay, I'll keep on going. And at the tail end is when I almost blew it all. When he lost his hearing aid, I was on the tip of my tongue to blurt out, "You may be the luckiest man in America," but there was a guardian angel on my shoulder that prevented me from doing it. Well, I wasn't prepared for the vehemence of Quayle going after Clinton, not after Gore, and I don't think Gore was prepared for it either, because Quayle was on the attack against Clinton, who wasn't there, and Gore didn't quite know how to cope with it. At one point in the debate, I did have to really step in, and that's when the audience began to boo. And it was mostly Quayle supporters, I could sense, were doing it. And so I turned to the audience. I said, you know, this is not the American way. We don't do that type of thing here. And I ask you to stop doing it because all you're doing is distracting from your own candidates. And it worked. There was no problem after that. Had it not worked, I would have then gone to then-Vice President Quayle and asked him to tell his people to stop doing it. But it wasn't necessary.
Do you feel that you ever lost control of the debate?
I don't think I ever really lost control of it. I think I was somewhat handicapped by the format. It could have been better. And the reason I say that is this. As moderator, and don't forget, these debates were thrown together in just a matter of days. All of a sudden, you know, we had, what, four debates within a 9-day period there. So they were just thrown together. And I was thrown into a very strict format, in which everything had to move precisely minute by minute, and there was no room for the moderator to do any follow-up. And I think that was what was lacking in the debate, that I couldn't pin him down. Like, at one point I tried, and I said, well, you know, none of you have answered the question that I asked, you know. And I had to move on because we had run out of time. I think we're better off in debates if you try and ask fewer questions or present fewer topics and do a better job with more cross-discussion. And I think there should be a little bit of leeway there for the moderator to have some time to follow up. Also, I think it's much better to have everybody sitting at a table rather than those podiums where they're separated from each other. I think everybody's sitting around a table, it's much more conducive to a discussion. And also, I think it's probably easier for the moderator to control.
Hal Bruno is my guest, director of political coverage for ABC. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. Sure. This is Fresh Air. Back with Hal Bruno, director of political coverage for ABC News, and we're talking about coverage of the campaign. Would you say your network is doing anything different this time around in covering the election?
I don't think we're doing anything necessarily that's different because 4 years ago, I think we took a different turn. We had been journalism in general, had been criticized after the 88 campaign that we devoted too much time to the horse race, which I don't agree with, but anyhow, we were criticized and not enough to issues. And so this time, I think, starting 4 years ago, everybody's become much more self-conscious about the need to make sure that we're going heavy on the issues, and we do that. You know, also, the issues of a campaign are basically the news of the day, and we cover the news of the day every single day, every hour of the day. And this idea that we don't cover the issues, I never ever bought that as a legitimate criticism, because we do cover the issues. And we now take special pains to put them into the context of a political campaign.
I wonder how tabloids are affecting your coverage of the campaign. For example, the Dick Morris story, broken by a tabloid. When did you pick up the story, and did you feel like it was a story you should be picking? When did you feel it was worth picking up, that it was a legitimate story?
The tabloids have become a problem for American journalism in general, not just television. Everybody is confronted with this problem, and nobody has really come to grips with it yet. My own feeling is that journalism as an institution, is suffering from a lack of discipline, and that in too many cases, the tabloids, which is the lowest rung on the journalism ladder, I guess, and I don't want to sound snobbish about that, but they're really calling the shots for too many publications and broadcast, because the leadership has abdicated its responsibility. When I started as a reporter many years ago in Chicago, I come from the Chicago Police Reporter School of Journalism. When I started, I worked on a newspaper. If the other newspaper broke a story and scooped us, we could not pick up that story and run with it, even if we gave them credit, which we would never want to do. But even if we did give them credit, we couldn't do that. We had to check it out and verify it ourselves. And if it was true, then we would try and develop a new angle, new aspect of the story, and then run it. If it wasn't true, then we'd run a story trying to embarrass them. Nowadays, everybody seems to think it's okay to pick up a story and go with it, and all you got to do is say that the New York such-and-such reported this, and therefore that makes it legitimate to carry the story. I'm not so sure that's right. Now, in the case specifically of the Dick Morris story, we picked it up only when it became a topic. Was it having an impact on the campaign? And that was the approach we took to the story. And we did as little as possible with it, because we've learned the hard way that these stories, I'm trying to find the right words, what we're doing is we're struggling to try and be responsible journalists.
Tabloids are paying people for stories, and then the other journalists have to scratch their heads and decide whether they should pick up on the story or not. And once one major media outlet picks it up, everybody else tends to pick it up too. What do you think the correct position is to take toward the tabloid stories when you know that
I don't think, first of all, as soon as you know a source is paid, there's a taint on it right off the bat. I think you got to take each one case by case. There have been times when I have advocated, let's dig in, let's not do it, you know, let's not get stampeded. There have been other times when I realize, hey, you know, I wish I could say that, but the truth is this has got a life of its own, and this is something that is going to have an impact, and we cannot pretend that it's not happening, so we have to pick it up and go with it.
What's an example of the latter?
Oh, well, I think to a lesser degree, I suppose the Morris story is an example of that. I think the Jennifer Flowers thing with Clinton 4 years ago, that was one that, you know, when it first broke, there weren't many of us wanted to have anything to do with that one. And at the same time, when certain things happened, then it took on a life of its own, and it was going to have, you know, an impact, become a part of the whole campaign thing, so you had to cover it. I was worried about, not worried isn't the right word, as a journalist I was concerned about, are we being used? in a wrong way. The same thing, there were stories at one time about George Bush having a mistress, and this was really an effort to manipulate us. This was back around 1987, before the 88 campaign began, and it became very clear that people were trying to manipulate us so that we would ask the question at a press conference and legitimize what was nothing more than a scurrilous rumor. And that's the only time I ever conspired with my counterparts at other networks, because the same thing was happening to them. And we agreed, and some people in the print press as well, and we all agreed that we were going to dig in and we're not going to allow ourselves to be stampeded.
What convinced you it was a rumor and that it wasn't worth investigating?
Well, first of all, we had people investigated. I assigned people
to
work on this thing, and let's check it out and see if it's true. And we could not find a shred of evidence to support it. And furthermore, the way it was coming to us, it didn't take a genius to figure out that somebody was trying to stampede us and get us to legitimize this scurrilous, unprovable rumor by asking it in a public forum of some sort, which all of us refused to do. And so that story never got off the ground until a few years later, finally, somebody did ask the question. I guess it was in going into the 92 campaign, something that we thought had all been put aside years earlier. It came back again, and that's the way these things happen. But it shows you what the pitfalls are, and it shows you the pressures that you come under in making these decisions. It's not easy.
The thing that doesn't seem to fit on your resume, filled with all this political reporting and so on, is that you're an authority on fire safety. You write a monthly column for Firehouse Magazine, serves as a volunteer firefighter. What's that about?
That's my other life. I always was torn between journalism and the fire department. I started riding the fire trucks in Chicago when I was 15 years old. I'd hung around the firehouses the time I was 10. And I was really torn whether I was going to become a reporter or a firefighter. And when I came back from the Army after the Korean War in 1953, I missed the fire department exam by a month. So I went to work at City News Bureau in Chicago as a police reporter and got my training. And eventually got on a Chicago newspaper. And then by the time the next fire department exam came up, I had already won some prizes, and I had a chance to go to India on a Fulbright scholarship and become eventually a foreign correspondent, which was my other goal. So I stayed in journalism, but I never lost my love of the fire department and fire, the whole thing of fire safety. And wherever I lived, I've always been a part of the fire department. I was an active volunteer firefighter for 40 years until age and old injuries finally caught up with me. And about 20 years ago, I started writing this column on fire politics for Firehouse Magazine, and thinking that this was just a one-shot thing. Well, it's still going strong. And through it all, I've gotten involved in all kinds of things that I never thought of when I wanted to become a fireman. I just wanted to fight fires, and now I've gotten involved in all kinds of things with fire safety. I'm a director of the Fallen Firefighters Foundation, which helps take care of the families of firefighters who are killed in the line of duty. And I've served on all kinds of panels and things. Firefighting, fire safety have been a truly major part of my life and an enrichment of my life.
Have you ever had to deal with a fire at work or at home?
Oh, I've had a little fire in my home. It's always embarrassing, too. Like a light ballast shorted out, and I called up and said, okay, just send one engine. And they just laughed, you know, because they knew it was my house. And, of course, protocol is you don't just send one engine. You got to send two engines, the ladder truck and the squad and everything.
Hal Bruno is director of political coverage for ABC News. Coming up, REM's new CD, This Is Fresh Air. The new collection from REM, New Adventures in Hi-Fi, was recorded in studios, dressing rooms, and bathrooms all over the country in off moments when the band was on tour during the past 2 years. Rather than sounding scattered or distracted, rock critic Ken Tucker says the band has created one of their most unified and intimate albums.
What do you see? All of you and all of me, fluorescent stars. Some of them they surprise. The bus rider went to write this 4 a.m. letter. The fields of poppies, little pearls. All the boys and all the girls, sweet tooth, each and every one a little scary. I said your name.
That's the first single from New Adventures in Hi-Fi called Ebo the Letter. It's a song in the favored mode of this album. Singer Michael Stipe lets loose with a torrent of words, of discrete images that cohere as a statement of isolation, loneliness, of pity for someone else's pain, or for one's own. Midway through Ebo, Patti Smith's voice wafts through the mix. REM uses her both for her music, to provide wailing incantations that contrast with Stipe's dry voice, and for her power as an icon, as a punk-era muse. This is the first REM album in which they treat themselves as old pros, looking back to their original inspirations. You can hear this theme again in The Wake-Up Bomb. The title image refers to 70s punk, which served as an exploding wake-up call to the exhausted music of the times.
I look good in the glass pack. I look good in me. I look good in metallic silk, wrapped around. I skirt along the horizon. I drink some sweet tea, tea. I get high in my low ass boot cut tea. I like being seen. I look good in my drink, get no sleep. Take a leap in longevity. I get high on my attitude. Latitude 1973.
Because of the sporadic, piecemeal, often spontaneous way it was recorded, New Adventures in Hi-Fi operates as a kind of diary, with Michael Stipe articulating thoughts that seem to have occurred to him at the end of a long day or during a long, trying period. It's been widely reported that during this time, REM's drummer Bill Berry suffered a brain aneurysm that very nearly killed him. That and other illnesses that put Stipe and bassist Mike Mills in the hospital at other times lend the new album an air of meditation. I hesitate to call it a record of recovery, given the banal associations surrounding what's become known as the recovery movement, but it's difficult to listen to a wonderful, alluring song like Undertow without hearing it as a musical description of death escaped.
Brother, can you see those birds? They don't look to heaven. They don't need religion. They can see. You go down to the water. Drink down with the water. Fly up off the water. Leave it be. But this is not my time, sister. It is cold in heaven. No one's coming out.
There's an energy and a willfulness to New Adventures in Hi-Fi that give this collection a force I've often found missing in REM's work. If the best thing about the band is that it's often managed to convey slacker despair without cliches or undue moroseness, the best thing about New Adventures in Hi-Fi is that it celebrates renewed lives without false optimism or a trace of sentimentality.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed New Adventures in Hi-Fi by REM. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Technical direction from Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
I never thought of this as funny. It speaks another world to me.
Fresh Air is available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $15.45 and includes shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air is provided by the George Gund Foundation and the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.